Hi, folks. Next up on This Week in Law, we've got scraping, we've got hacking, smearing, and Napster for finance. It must be time for This Week in Law. We've got Lisa Borodkin joining us today. Stay tuned next on Twill.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 243, recorded January 24th, 2014. Intriguingly, Hogan. Hi, folks. You're joining us for This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell, here with my co-host, Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Happy Friday to you. Good to see you.
Happy Friday to you. Joining us this week, we have Lisa Borodkin, who is returning to the show after a year hiatus from joining us. We have to remedy that. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Denise. Hi, Evan.
Hello,
great
hello.
To have you back on. What's going on with you these days? Here. Let's catch us up.
It's been an exciting year. I'm consulting to a couple of copyright and toy industry clients and teeing up in my private practice to start a couple of new cases. Should be interesting there. And excited to return to South by Southwest Interactive in March. And that's pretty much what's going on for the first quarter this year.
Are you on a panel again at South by Southwest?
No, I'm not going on a panel this year, although my good friend Christina Gagne is doing a panel that should be of great interest and very related to topics that I frequently speak on revenge porn. That's a constantly evolving area of law, so I look forward to checking that out and all the other great speakers.
Well, I thought we'd check in this week at the top of the show, since it happened last week, kind of as we were doing the show, President Obama announcing his NSA reforms. So let's look at this privacy issue first. Of course, lots of our other stories today have privacy overtones too, so that can be just sort of an overarching theme of the show today. But we did get word from the Obama administration announcing reforms of the National Security Agency's surveillance programs. And basically, there weren't too many surprises there. More transparency being afforded to companies who want to let people know exactly what they're being asked to, provided more freedom and flexibility to disclose that information. And there's a really good article by Stephen Levy at Wired going over the ramifications of the reforms for Silicon Valley firms. And his overall take, having parsed the president's remarks, is that he's not too sanguine that Silicon Valley firms are going to be able to salvage and restore the public trust in the fact that they're holding a lot of our data. Evan, do you agree with Stephen Levy that that's going to be a tough thing to shore up?
Well, I mean, the way I read his article here is that Silicon, I mean, and to a great extent, he's having to divine a lot what Silicon Valley firms like might be thinking about, like, you know, for example, Google and Apple might be thinking about in all of this, is that there's no cause for celebration yet because of the presidential order here, because it didn't do away with the surveillance program altogether. And so that's why it didn't go far enough. Clearly, the biggest thing to be optimistic about and to be pleased about from all this is, as you mentioned there, Denise, the greater increase in transparency. And that's going to benefit not only the providers of service, the Silicon Valley firms who provide these massive platforms, but also the users as well. Because the biggest thing that just gets us at a real gut level in all this is the fact that our communications, the metadata about those communications, to be fair and accurate about this, seems to just go out there into a black box. Especially with proceedings in front of the FISA court, this whole notion of the secrecy in which all of this is clouded leaves us pretty uncomfortable about the sorts of information that's being gathered, what information the government is looking for, how often it's done. So I think that will do quite a bit to mitigate public concern, this greater notion of transparency, more information about what information is gathered in relation to the overall volume of information that the companies have about us. That should do something to set the public at ease. As far as the ultimate conclusion of Stephen Levy's article here, again, it doesn't sound like anything short of having done away with the NSA data collection program would have gotten him to say anything positive or to come out with a completely positive pronouncement about it here.
All right. There are some more reforms aside from simply giving companies the ability to talk more than they've been able to in the past. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court is going to add members with expertise in civil liberties and technology and is going to be authorized to declassify or maybe ordered to declassify more of its decisions. Also, there's going to be a review panel to figure out the government's stance on big data privacy. And Stephen Levy points out in his article, this could be helpful because U.S. companies are constantly trying to keep up with the different laws that they have to comply with, both in the United States and internationally, particularly in the EU, where privacy rules are much more restrictive. But on the other hand, Stephen is worried that this panel might take not such a positive view of the practices that companies are engaged in. The president himself in his remarks said something his exact quote was, "The challenges to our privacy do not come from government alone. Corporations of all shapes and sizes track what you buy, store and analyze our data, and use it for commercial purposes. That's how those targeted ads pop up on your computer or your smartphone." So it sounds like President Obama's not telling Silicon Valley that you know they're off the hook either. If the government is getting a whole bunch of flack for looking into people's data, I guess you know the message here is that you're making it not just easy for the government to do it, but you're making use of that data as well. Lisa, what do you think the response to this is going to be?
Well, I think that everyone is sort of uniformly meh about it. It was very interesting to shed a light, though, on what we currently have in terms of transparency in the NSA's collection of data. There is also an article in Ars Technica that goes over some points in the report. And one thing that I found interesting was that this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court or whatever, even though it's called a court, it really doesn't have much transparency. Apparently, it's a court only open to the government. And apparently, one of Obama's notes there was that he's going to pay to have a human rights representative on this court, which to people like us who are used to the adversarial, open and public process is kind of like, okay, great. I mean, if you're going to call it a court, why don't you have something that most of us are used to? But it's an incredibly Byzantine scheme, it seems to me. I mean, these Silicon Valley companies have done quite a bit with our personal data themselves. I mean, most of their business models incorporate in some way quantifying advertising to or collecting our data somehow. So, you know, it's something to study and to watch. Took the point of the article to be that they're all in it together, government and Silicon Valley. So they might as well keep talking, keep working together. But the more transparency there is, the better it is ultimately for those of us who use and are monitored by these services.
Yeah, Evan, what do you think of Lisa's point that it's sort of facile to call the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court a court per se, because it's really more of a star chamber?
Right. Yeah, it's definitely not what we're used to in as far as being, you know, with our government not operating incommunicado like that. Historically, we're not used to that. And I think we have a lot of aversion from that going all the way back to the colonial days. That's why the judiciary was set up as it was in the Constitution to be that way. So, but one point, going to what the president said about, you know, it's not just the government, but it's also the Silicon Valley firms who are partly responsible here. It looks like he's doing a great job of trying to have it both ways there, of having these private enterprises being the subject of some finger pointing here, saying, hey, they're the ones who are the privacy violators here. But he's also able, or when I say he, I'm talking about the federal government, the NSA in general, also able to very much be the beneficiary of all of that data collection as well, with the agreements with Verizon and the various the disclosures that have come out, you know, from Ed Snowden, the PRISM program, and all that stuff. You know, which is it? Is it should private industry be the subject of finger pointing, or should they be recognized as this real boon to the government and its surveillance program as well? And that seems like perhaps slightly more than just a rhetorical question here, but it underscores the real problem as to the fact that there are these enterprises collecting these vast amounts of data, and we don't enjoy the same kind of built-in privacy protections when that information is in the hands of private enterprise as what we would if it were trying to be grabbed on by the government straight from us with the protections of the Fourth Amendment.
All right. Well, having gone through that, let's move on to some social web stories that also all have privacy overtones. So, Lisa, sticking with our theme of catching up with you, you have been involved both as counsel for a third party and then as a litigant yourself with the company Ripoff Report. Why don't you start, get us up to speed on the history, start with your representation of Asia Economic Institute. Let us know what happened in that case and then take us up to present day.
Oh, sure. It's quite an interesting story. So I am a internet and intellectual property lawyer. And I guess it was about 3 or 4 years ago, I was contacted by a potential client who had a lawsuit on file, basically bringing claims against the owners of the Ripoff Report website for their business model, which this plaintiff had claimed amounted to attempted extortion. So it's a familiar business model to those of us who have been monitoring the internet and commercial law over the internet for several years, which is basically it collects third-party reports or content, makes them available on the web, and then charges a fee to modify or investigate the content of the reports. So I litigated that case with another co-counsel, and like every law student is told, the case had numerous twists and turns, and it was eventually resolved in about 2012. Some of the claims were resolved on dismissal, some of them by summary judgment, some of them were dropped, but the whole case finally was resolved. I think it was May of 2011. Throughout the case, the attorneys for Ripoff Report had basically said that they were going to bring malicious prosecution claims against my clients and myself and my co-counsel, unless, and then a list of conditions were provided that I was not authorized to accept on behalf of my clients. And so after that case was resolved, I was sued personally in Arizona for malicious prosecution of that case. So that case went on for a while. I eventually had the case dismissed under the federal rule that allows for dismissal of a case if the court determines that there's just no claim there. And that case has been under appeal. But throughout the course, and that case, according to the Ninth Circuit frequently asked questions, you know, that case should be ready for oral argument around September of this year, 9 to 12 months after it was briefed. So the case generated a lot of interest for a variety of reasons. And there's been numerous blog posts on aspects of all the many, many lawsuits that people bring against Ripoff Report. This case, I think, opened some insights into the operation of the business and also clarified some aspects of the law. I think that the story should be told, and there should be equal coverage given to, you know, the fact that, the lawyers were sued, which, you know, as lawyers, we all know we have certain responsibilities. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I mean, I just didn't, feel that just the threat of personal liability, should prevent a litigant from having their day in court. And unfortunately we see a lot of chilling effects, because a lot of lawyers, for various reasons, very understandably, you know, they just don't want to be caught up in litigation themselves. A lot of cases don't get brought, and a lot of stories don't get reported.
Well, Ripoff Report tries on its front page to have a very chilling effect on anyone who might sue it. Right there, you know, among the most prominent links are this on the site is a heading set that says, "Thinking of suing Ripoff Report? If you're considering filing a lawsuit against Ripoff Report, click here for important information about applicable federal law." Do you really want to sue Ripoff Report? You really need to read this link. Tell us a little bit, Lisa, about how Ripoff Report is a different flavor of entity than something like Yelp, and also what federal laws they're citing to support their business model.
Well, I don't want to get too close to the merits of the appeal. So I'll just give the caveat that I'm trying to restrict my remarks to things that have been actually asserted in the public record in the cases. And I'm really going to try to stay away from any kind of speculation or any kind of editorializing.
Sure.
So how is it different from Yelp? It depends on how you look at the business model, and that's a very fact-specific question. I would say that it might be different in terms of degrees, but actually the claims against Ripoff Report that were brought in this California case, Asia Economic Institute versus Accenturic, were similar to the current claims against Yelp in Levitt versus Yelp. If you're familiar with that case, that's essentially, last I checked, trying to plead claims for unfair business practices, unfair advertising, violations of California's unfair competition law. And the commonality there is an allegation that the businesses don't adequately disclose to consumers or to the public reading the content on their websites their own financial interest in how they operate the site. And in fact, in the Arizona case against me, the judge found that our allegations in the Asia Economic case were very similar to the allegations in the Yelp case, Levitt versus Yelp, that Judge Patel had found could sustain an unfair competition law claim. And based on that, found essentially that because it was a viable sort of a claim, it had probable cause. The fact that we litigated that claim meant that a malicious prosecution claim could not be asserted against the attorneys. So one unusual aspect, however, of the Ripoff Report business that does distinguish it from Yelp, and this is again is the last time I checked, which was a couple of years ago, but Ripoff Report purports to take an exclusive worldwide perpetual copyright in any reports that are submitted to it. So the moment somebody decides they're going to write a Ripoff Report and publish it on Ripoff Report's website, according to their terms of service, Ripoff Report then becomes the copyright owner of that content. And I've never seen that on any other consumer review site or social networking site. Usually it's a perpetual worldwide non-exclusive copyright that the user agrees to. And that issue was alleged in our case, but it actually has never been really fully litigated. It would be an interesting question as to whether that has any effect on the exclusion from liability under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, because if you're transferring content to someone who started off as a publisher but then becomes the owner, would that necessarily alter the fact that the website is no longer just an interactive service provider but actually becomes a participant in the distribution or creation of that content? So that's an interesting question. But I think that's sort of in a nutshell the most pertinent similarity to a website like Yelp, and then also one of the most, to me, one of the most interesting distinctions.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. I agree that that whole aspect of not just getting a license from the users, but actually purporting through their terms of service to make a transfer of copyright come about could shade the whole Communications Decency Act analysis. You know, when I'm now reading through this whole long dissertation about why you don't want to sue us on the Ripoff Report site, and it's very Communications Decency Act centric, as one might expect, and makes some pretty definitive statements in response to one, you know, hypothetical question: if you post something false about us, don't you have to take it down? They say, no, the CDA says we don't have to. If they actually purport to be the owners of the content on the site, Evan, don't you think that that could change the analysis?
If they purport to be the owners of the copyright, that would change the Section 230 analysis?
Yeah.
Is that what we're going to...
Right.
I don't know.
You're no longer publishing. You're not just making it a pass-through anymore. You're no longer just a third party.
I don't know. I hear what you're saying, and Lisa, I hear what you're saying with that. But you know, it seems like Section 230 immunity is so robust, and sites can do so much with the content editorially. I think the case law generally says that they can perform the traditional editorial functions and still be within Section 230 immunity. I'm not so sure that ownership, I guess I would just need to think about it. This is really kind of a matter or an issue of first impression in my mind. You know, when you brought it up there, Lisa, whether copyright ownership would somehow make the website owner more of a creator of that content and therefore outside of the protections of Section 230. But my initial impulse is to think that doesn't really do, that's really just a change in status. And, you know, there's really no movement. There's no activity that actually happens when that is. It's just a kind of sort of a metaphysical or ontological change in status, who owns the copyright here. So I guess I'm skeptical about all of that. So
yeah, but I think it would be interesting to have it litigated, because that change in status is pretty important for purposes of Section 230. You know, being a third party is pretty critical to the protections that are granted by the statute. If you're no longer a third party, if you are, you know, the rights holder, I think it could make a difference, but again, we're just sort of spitballing this.
Right. What I really want to talk about is just kind of add to what Lisa was saying. You know, since Denise, you and I not being involved in litigation with Ripoff Report are at greater liberty to just talk about what a circus it really is. You can hear how Lisa is being measured, rightfully so, wisely so, in her remarks about it. But, you know, Ripoff Report is quite a circus compared to Yelp. Yelp truly is, I believe, despite the shenanigans that go on the site because of its users, does intend to be a legitimate service that actually does provide information, reviews for that are helpful to consumers. Whereas Ripoff Report, for years and years and years, you can just tell it's trying to stir up trouble and trying to be a destination on the web that is a lightning rod, to provide this platform for controversial content. And the very fact that they would put that so front and center, do you really want to sue us? I mean, that just goes to show the whole attitude here. And I would submit that the reasonably informed internet user doing a search on a business, seeing something on Ripoff Report, knows or at least has a strong inclination that that content originated from somebody who had an axe to grind with that company. I mean, that they've chosen to report. I mean, it's called Ripoff Report after all. It's not called it's not called Yelp for one thing.
It's not called Bad Customer Service Report or
it's not called something. It, certainly not anything positive about the company. It's not even anything neutral. So it doesn't invite. Mm-hmm. Positive commentary. And I suppose if one were to do empirical studies on this, most of the content on Ripoff Report, just like it would be with Pissed Consumer or any other of the other, in that ilk of review sites, they're all going to be negative. So how much credibility is a reasonable person going to give to that content in the first place? You just know that there was an axe to grind in most instances in the first to give the impulse to put that content on there in the first place. So I just wanted to kind of add to that where Lisa was being measured. I'll just go ahead and say it. It's a circus.
It's a circus. I don't know enough about Ripoff Report, only, have sort of come into contact with coverage on it through Lisa and her initial case and then the subsequent case. I think it's a really interesting area of the law to consider, because obviously we want to encourage consumer reports sort of sites to exist. We want to encourage people to be able to talk about their bad experiences with companies. And even if they have an axe to grind, even if they're, more bitter than they should be about those bad experiences, I think you want that information out there and you want people to be able to judge for themselves, what the legitimacy of that information is. But is it true, Lisa, that in the complaints against this company, including the one you filed on behalf of your client and maybe others, that they're being alleged to have taken it further than simply publishing negative commentary to, saying, hey, if you want this off the site, we've got some terms we could discuss with you? Are there sort of extortionate allegations being made here?
Oh, actually, I forgot the main difference between Ripoff Report and a site like Yelp. Ripoff Report claims that even if the content is false, even if you get a judgment against the author of the report stating that it's false, they will refuse to remove the report. And every other website, if you send them a judgment, and I've done it with many, dozens of websites, if you send them a judgment saying a statement is defamatory and false, they will, according to their terms of use, implement their terms and remove that content voluntarily. So Ripoff Report claims that it will not do that. So the only options that you would have, according to them, would be to join their corporate advocacy program, which costs, I think it starts at $7,500 and then yearly payments. Or you can now do their arbitration program, where then they run the arbitration. And I don't remember how much that costs, maybe a couple thousand dollars. And if you win the arbitration with their arbitrator, they will redact your name from the report. So the main difference is essentially, yes, they won't just, according to them, they won't just take down a report. They sort of pride themselves on putting information up there, according to them, and it will stay up there forever. Unless you do one of their two programs.
What do you think about that model, Evan?
I'm freaking out because the Gmail is down and it's been down for like 15 minutes. And I think the whole internet's going to come to a screeching halt here. But back to Ripoff Report. That just shows what a circus it is. I hope that program is not making Ripoff Report a lot of money. I hope businesses are smarter than to fall into something like that for the very reasons that I was saying a while ago. I don't see how one can think that a sensible person will really see the harm of something having been posted on Ripoff Report in the first place. It's like, you know, should be presumed to be false if it's on Ripoff Report. But that is an interesting point. Lisa was talking about, what you were talking about, Lisa, about them not taking that content down. And even if it's, you know, defamatory or false or what have you. And in the Seventh Circuit, we've talked about this case a couple of times, Denise, the Blockowitz mm-hmm. case here in the Seventh Circuit even made it clear that an injunction or court order under Rule 65, the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure for injunctions ordering the site to take it down, doesn't reach Ripoff Report because it's not acting in conjunction with the party or whatever that language of Rule 65 talks about there. So it is quite a challenge to aggrieved parties who find themselves the subject of content on Ripoff Report, even to have a remedy in from a court to get that content taken down. So, I can't say it any more strenuously that just the whole premise on which the site is based seems to lack a lot of legitimate strength.
Okay, well, Lisa, you gave us another topic to discuss today that implicates Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, and that has to do with posting one's mugshots online that are in the public record. A site that was doing this actually reached a settlement over it. Can you bring us up to speed there? And why is this case interesting and important?
Oh, sure. I was actually emailed this by one of my clients who's kind of interested in this whole type of business model in general. Which is, there's a bunch of websites out there that are apparently in the business of scraping what they claim are the public record and posting people's mugshots with their names there. And if one comes across this in a Google search, for example, or a Bing search, and emails them, they will offer to remove it for, you know, a sum of money that I'm sure in the aggregate can total up to a nice steady stream of income. So this was a class action in the Northern District of Ohio in Toledo, where I thought it was very creative. The class representative's attorney basically filed a claim under Ohio's name and likeness right of publicity statute, saying, look, here are all the people in the country whose mugshots and names are appearing on this website, and the business is making money from the value, the public value of their personas, in that it's charging money to remove the mugshot, or, you know, you can pay extra to have an expedited removal, et cetera, et cetera. And based on that, they reached a settlement, and the website apparently stopped doing that. And then there was a secondary business, which was a business that was sort of like one of these reputation repair businesses, and they were part of the settlement too. So I looked at the complaint because I saw the article saying that the mugshot website had reached a settlement, but I was just very curious about what the legal theory had been. And this is one of the first cases I've seen where somebody asserted with some success, if you call a settlement a success, the right of publicity of just ordinary citizens, you know, ordinary 200,000 odd people whose names were deemed or alleged to have some commercial value, if only the value of having it removed.
Yeah, that is a very interesting twist in this case. We tend to think of right of publicity statutes as having been enacted with celebrities in mind, people who can point to their name and likeness and talk about concrete commercial value that is there if it's used without their permission. It is good to see someone asserting that your Joe Blow mugshot photography subject might be also in the lofty realm of the celebrity world and able to assert legal rights of publicity and ownership in the ability to control their name and likeness. Certainly not the first time that we've seen that come up, but it's not the norm, is it, Evan?
No, and I think that the shift that we're seeing here is probably the result of the way that media is evolving. When we, you know, when our knee-jerk reaction is to think that rights of publicity attach only to celebrities, which, you know, really isn't borne out by a reading of most of the statutes that deal with this. You know, the right of publicity could belong to anyone for their use mm-hmm. being with their name, image, or likeness being used for commercial purposes. There's really no meaningful distinction in most of the statutes about this. But we think of it in, you know, this area of the law evolving back in the day where the ability to distribute media was centralized in just a few powerful players, broadcasters, television, movies, you know, the press, what have you. But now with media moving from being centralized to more of a social media, it's natural to recognize the legal expansion, or at least the normative way that we're thinking about these things. So it's an interesting observation to make as technology evolves to see the legal notions change as well.
Lisa, I know we never had a court, you know, look at these legal issues and pass on them because the parties reached a settlement, but do you think it would have made a big difference if they were not charging money, if the business model hadn't been all about, you know, we'll take your mugshot down if you pay us? What if they had just been posting the mugshots and sort of passively getting income off the site through ads?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I think that would make it a much harder case. Because it seems to me that an element of the statute that they were proceeding under was that they were deriving commercial benefit from the use of their name or likeness or persona. And I could definitely see a court passing on it as a case of first impression, wanting to read the statute very strictly, like a quasi-criminal statute, and saying, well, advertising is not exactly deriving benefit directly from the value of the name or likeness. So I do think that would change things.
Do you agree, Evan?
Well, here's how I would look at it. I think that there is a distinction to be made as to whether or not a website is selling the content itself versus relying on revenue because of the traffic that the content generates. And I'm actually drawing that notion from a decision that that I blogged about this past week about the, and this isn't in our you know, things to review for the show or in our show notes or anything like that, but there's this ongoing litigation involving the Hulk Hogan sex tape and whether Gawker violated Hulk Hogan's right of publicity or privacy rights. You know, there were several claims in there by posting excerpts of that the Hulk Hogan sex tape on Gawker back in 2012. And the court now, the second court, there's been a state court and a federal, there's been a federal district court and a state appellate court now hold that Gawker had the First Amendment right to do that. And one of the reasons that the court held that the private interest of Hulk Hogan in his privacy was outweighed by the public interest was because this was not for commercial purposes. And to drop some really provocative content into our show today, it looked back to the 1998 case involving the sex tape with Bret Michaels and Pamela Anderson. And in that case, the court found that it was indeed a commercial use being made of the tape because the distribution company was just selling the video. But the court in the Hulk Hogan sex tape case said, and I'm just reading from the opinion here, this is over on my blog at internetcases.com, says, we are aware that Gawker Media is likely to profit indirectly from publishing the report of video excerpts to the extent that it increases traffic to Gawker Media's website. However, this is distinguishable from selling the Hulk sex tape purely for commercial purposes. So I would suggest that the same distinction could be made there on a mugshot website where your subscription is ostensibly to come and see the photos, you know, which is more like actually selling the content rather than having it there and the revenue model being based on, one in every 6,500 users may click on one of those links over there on the right hand side and earn us 3 pennies or something like that. I would say that would play into it at a certain level.
Interesting. Yeah. It'll be, I think you've pointed out a case that could be relevant along these lines, Evan. And I think, you know, as we continue to have the web be so ad supported and have that be maybe not the primary business model, but a really central one, I think we'll continue to run up against this question of whether that's a commercial use for purposes of all kinds of statutes or not. So let's move on to another story. I said a lot of these have privacy overtones. I think you can see what I mean. This one caught my eye last week. We didn't get a chance to talk about it, but I wanted to highlight it for folks because I think it's, you know, at least slightly controversial. And this is by Adrian Jeffries over at The Verge, did a story. And I guess it was originally reported in the Wall Street Journal, talking about lenders. You know, we've talked about insurance companies looking at your social media breadcrumbs to see what they can glean about your riskiness as an insured. Lenders now looking at Facebook and other social media in order to determine one's credit worthiness. And when that is the case, there's so much consumer protection law that involves the process of lending money that goes to that, that I think that this is a real interesting practice that could run afoul of some of that consumer protection law. And certainly, you know, it's not the first thing that you think of when you get up and post on your Facebook page in the morning is that, you know, if you're getting a home loan, if you've made that public, it could be something that a lender would look at to determine, you know, if you're shirking your job that day or not, you know, how likely you are to remain employed. So I wanted to toss this out for our panel's consideration. What do you think about looking at social media for credit worthiness, Evan?
I get the sense that the vox populi for this would be to think that this is a bad thing. And, you know, probably it is because it's going to involve some judgments to be made that could be based on empirical data that's incomplete. You know, what I mean by that is a lender determining credit worthiness is making a judgment about the borrower. And it could be judgments ultimately the judgment is, are they going to be able to pay this money back? And to break that issue down, they look at, well, what kind of person is this? What kind of habits do they have? What have they done in the past? Who do they associate with? What assets do they have? If we think about looking at social media to help make that judgment, I think the concern that we would have is that people only put a limited amount of information about themselves on social media. They try to paint the best possible picture of themselves, or they try to paint a picture, and this could actually, but both of these things could be true. They try to paint the best possible picture of themselves, or they paint a picture and or paint a picture of themselves that is not quite true. Maybe they're a little bit cooler in the picture that they paint themselves on social media than what they are. And that might mean they're trying to paint a picture of themselves as being more reckless. You know, if I was trying to, I don't want to stereotype or make too many judgments, but if I was, you know, trying to portray myself as more of a rebellious type or whatever, I'd be more risk-taking. I would, you know, say this was me doing 120 down the freeway on my motorcycle when I don't even own a motorcycle. Where am I going with this? I have no idea.
We're happy to just let you zoom on down the freeway, Evan.
Where are you going?
There's an image for you. So, I mean, there's a couple of things. If we're going to be making these judgments, maybe we want the most information as possible. And that's what I would say, against what I feel is probably most people's reaction to this is that this is a bad thing. This is invasive of privacy. But don't we want lenders to make good judgments, you know, the correct judgment? And isn't it more likely that the correct judgment will be made if the fullest data set is available? But at the same time, I think with social media, we think of that sort of as different than just these more objective facts as to where we work, how much money we have, how much, what our credit history is, and all that stuff. So I would, I think the real interesting discussion is in evaluating why it is that it may or may not be a positive thing.
Well, in the Wall Street Journal, it's reported that FICO, which stands for the Fair Isaac Corp, a little bit of trivia there. They're the company that provides the credit scores used in more than 90% of lenders' decisions in lending to you. It says it's weighing possibilities for incorporating social media, but there are some other lenders out there who say they're already doing it. So does this give you pause, Lisa?
I think the whole thing is a good argument for investing in Bitcoin. I mean, it's just the kind of thing that makes me think, oh, internet, you know, I don't think that, I mean, unless some scientific data comes out that actually correlates the reliability of what people post about themselves on social media and, you know, some sort of accurate, sort of significant data that can enhance credit profiles. It seems sort of gimmicky. I'm skeptical about how more, you know, put it this way. Social media is an easy medium to game. So how are you going to account for people posting, hey, I got 5 new jobs today,
right?
Or, you know, I'm going sailing on my yacht. Where am I going to put all my extra money? I mean, that just seems like an invitation for people to pump up their credit scores. And, you know, back, you know, we just had a whole financial debacle based on, you know, sort of paper millionaires. So, you know, I'll believe it when we get some reliable scientific data showing that social media is a good place to find accurate empirical financial data.
Yeah, I love that idea that people are using their LinkedIn account to boost their credit score with this in mind. 'Cause you never know. I mean, it certainly might be an effective way to get it up there. So yeah, the next financial collapse, I guess we can blame on FICO and its trusting social media as a reliable source of information. I want to jump back a story here just to drop in our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. When we were talking about the mugshot settlement, someone in IRC said that sites that post those photos are called muggies. Have you guys ever heard of that term before? I looked it up on Urban Dictionary just now and did not get that definition. But since I implicitly trust IRC the way that FICO trusts social media, I'm going to go ahead and make muggies our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. Rhymes with huggies, folks, if you're concerned. And if you're keeping track or wondering why you would keep track of passphrases in the show, that's for people who are listening to get either continuing legal education or other professional education credit in their jurisdiction. We think that there's a lot of good and educational content on this show. This show certainly hasn't been an exception so far. So if you'd like some more information, if you're a lawyer or another professional where you think that this might be relevant to you, head on over to the Twit Wiki at wiki.twit.tv. Go to the This Week in Law page there. And we've got all kinds of information on how you might, what the various jurisdictions, at least for the lawyers, require. And many of them require that you demonstrate that you actually listened to or watched a program like this. So we're doing this for you guys. All right, let's move on to something else that Evan wrote about this week, in addition to the very fascinating Hulk Hogan and Gawker story. The one I did put in the rundown for the week has to do with if you are a plaintiff going after someone who you alleged bullied you, what you might have to hand over in the way of discovery. Can you tell us about this, Evan?
Sure. This is a case that actually came from, the federal court in the Northern District of Indiana. A high school student, he's probably out of high school by now, sued his school for failing to protect him from being bullied. And the defendant school district sought discovery from the plaintiff student and, among other things, said, give us all your social media, you know, every tweet, every status update. I love the boilerplate that seems to have spread virally in a lot of these things. Include all the causes joined. Isn't that something like Facebook circa 2008? But in any event,
all the causes you have joined.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I haven't been on Facebook for a couple of years, but I thought that was even, you know, that idea was gone even before I had left Facebook. But in any event, that's maybe Totally not the point. Hand us over everything. And there seems to be this thread developing in the case law about the discoverability of social media content in these types of cases, mm-hmm. where the courts will say, no, you don't have to turn over everything. But in situations where it's some form of harassment, whether it be bullying, and we've seen some other cases along these lines when it involves some sort of harassment in the workplace, sexual harassment or whatever other kinds of ill treatment one may suffer at work. In those types of cases, the courts are saying you plaintiff making these assertions only have to turn over social media evidence that relates to your feelings or your emotional state. So that's where the law seems to be going in all of this, when the facts asserted by the plaintiff are, hey, I suffered, you know, from this bad environment and you, defendant, are responsible for it. Defendant doesn't get to look at everything that person ever posted on social media, but only gets to look at those things that pertain to the plaintiff's emotions or feelings. And so to me, that's all well and good as a pronouncement as to what the law is or what the law ought to be. But practically speaking, where the rubber meets the road and you actually start culling out which items, which pieces of content the producing party, you know, the one who having to turn over the information has to turn over in the discovery process here, actually separating those things that pertain to your emotions and which don't seems to be extremely difficult. And to the extent that it's vague or difficult, subject to abuse and non-compliance. Because, you know, at what level does a piece of social media, at what point does it not pertain to your emotions or your feelings? I mean, some things are very clearly objective. Like, you know, here's a link to a story about the Hulk Hogan sex tape, period. But that's different than here's a link to a story about the Hulk Hogan sex tape, which I found to be very intriguing. You know, was that mm-hmm. second one, did that reflect my emotional state that I was intrigued by the Hulk Hogan sex tape? No, let's not even go there. how do we work that standard, actually? You know, what is what the law is when it comes to this discoverability of social media evidence, but how is it really workable when it really comes down to working in the trenches, these poor first and second year associates working in law firms deciding what to actually turn over in discovery? How do they really make that standard work?
Right. And just to bring you up to speed, yes, Facebook still has causes. I went and looked. They have a whole page type for causes. That could certainly be, even though that's in the boilerplate, you could certainly see where somebody's emotional state could be arguably gleaned by looking at the causes they had joined on a particular day. Any thoughts on this, Lisa?
Well, I actually was served with a similar sort of discovery request. And one of my responses was, I am not the custodian. I mean, I don't keep backlogs or backups of things that I've posted on social media going back years. I mean, if somebody wanted to discover tweets I had written going back a few years, I would say, fine, go ahead. It's in the cloud. Go find it. I think that The real significance of this sort of ruling, though, is again sort of an attempt by the court to catch up with what social media means to people nowadays. I mean, personally, if it's a bullying case, I sort of am skeptical about the relevance of emotions as expressed on social media at the time. And I feel that it's probably liable to do more psychological and emotional damage to the plaintiff, to force them to sort of relive that or parse through their private social network communications. I guess I was thinking about this. I would like to read the reasoning of the court in determining that this was relevant. I think that the main problem in implementing such a discovery rule, though, is whose job is it to actually go through the social media posts going back in time? I don't think most people really collect it. I mean, that's something you have to turn to the product to get. And at that
right,
point,
that's a really interesting point, especially as you're talking about, you know, trying to go back in time. You certainly have no control as a user over how much of your social media account you have access to in the case of something like Twitter, which does cut off, you know, what you have access to. But on the first point, I think, you know, you might find yourself, even though you're not the primary custodian, it's not residing on a server that you have any control over, you do have access to the account. And so if you were asked to go and find your posts that you did have access to, presumably you could at least get them. I mean, you could view them and then print them and turn them over. What do you think, Evan?
Yeah, I mean, I would not find it very persuasive as a judge if a litigant appeared before me and said, well, judge, it's on the Facebook server, so therefore I shouldn't have to turn it over. I mean, especially if this were in federal court, and I don't, you know, I certainly can't talk to the majority view on what the state rules of civil procedure say on this. But in the federal courts, you know, Rule 34 talks about an obligation that a producing party has to turn over information that's in its possession, custody, or control. And the case law that interprets that provision in the rules, not only in the social media context, but in other situations when the information is with a third party, you know, make it very clear that it's a document or discoverable evidence is in your possession, custody, or control if you have the legal right to access it. So it may not actually be in your file cabinet in the four walls of your office, but it may be off-site somewhere in a warehouse or something like that. It's not literally in your possession or custody then, but it's in your legal control because you have the legal right to go and use the key that you have to unlock it and go get it from the warehouse across town. So that's why I would find it I would not be persuaded to think that it wouldn't be within the scope of the information that's discoverable under that rule if it was, you know, just resided on a server somewhere, if I didn't have to violate the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act to get to it.
All right. So that's a good segue because we haven't talked about the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for a long time, and we have the opportunity to do so now. Tell us how one might find love on OkCupid by scraping the site, Evan.
Well, I guess I would talk to a mathematician, right? Yeah, this is an interesting situation. This guy, where is he? Somewhere out there, somewhere out west, right?
Somewhere, yes.
Everything happens, you know, everything exciting happens out there. I don't understand exactly how he did it because he's a brilliant mathematician, and he recognized that the method, it was in Los Angeles now, I remember, because there were the fact that registered with me is that he lived in Los Angeles. There were 80,000 women from Los Angeles signed up with profiles on OkCupid, but he still couldn't find anybody meaningful. So that's how this is coming back to me now. So he recognized that the way OkCupid works, you know, you answer a series of questions. Not everybody answers the same questions, but the algorithm matches perspective compatible parties couples based on the matches that you have with the selection of questions that are answered in a certain way. And he recognized that that wasn't working for him. So Adam Pennenberg over at Pando wrote about this. And there was also, he was actually writing about an article on Wired. I forget who wrote the Wired piece, but it goes into a lot of detail about what happened here. So this Kevin Paulson. Yes, of course. Mm-hmm. So this mathematician guy writes some Python scripts that goes and first of all, he set up some bogus profiles on OkCupid and then wrote some Python scripts to go cull a bunch of information so that he was able to ascertain more information than what he could just as one individual users about attractive prospective matches. And he used that then to put himself in a position to be more compatible with these women on OkCupid and thereby hopefully enjoy more evolutionary success in passing his genes on to the next generation, right? Isn't that what math is all about? So the question became then, did he violate the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act by doing what he did? And I guess the more specific questions would be by setting up these bogus accounts on OkCupid. You know, did that violate the terms of service? And was he as evil and as deserving of 35 years in jail as Aaron Swartz was? And also by scraping all of this content as well with these Python scripts. So it's this interesting theoretical question. I don't think he's been arrested or the feds aren't after him or anything like that, but there's this interesting question, you know, doing that, did he violate the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and commit this awful crime just trying to, you know, game the system and, you know, have more success on OkCupid. Interesting story.
Do you know what OkCupid's response to this has been? Did they deactivate his account? You know, how do we even know that this happened?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have to look in the story. That's a good question. I didn't really think about that. I guess we would look at the Wired piece because, you know, Kevin Paulson goes into a lot of detail about it there. So go and talk amongst yourself. I'll try to find an answer to that.
Okay.
According to the Wired story, OkCupid's computers noticed that he had these bots that were scraping the site of data in unusual ways, and they would sort of regularly deactivate the accounts associated with those bots. Uh-huh. So the guy also had to reverse engineer naturalistic behaving bots that would mimic the actual browsing activity of an actual OkCupid user. It's just a genius article. I love the story that Wired did. I love what the guy did. And living in Los Angeles, it's just a fascinating cluster of empirical information.
I sense this guy's credit score, credit worthiness rising even as we speak, because he's eminently employable based on these talents.
Oh, definitely. I mean, he's got a stylist. The Wired article describes him as tousled hair and blue eyes. You know?
He's so dreamy. Why was he having trouble on OkCupid? I'm sure he's found a date now, you know.
Well, actually, you know, the interesting thing about the article was that OkCupid's algorithms count not only the survey responses, but also the relative weight that the users placed onto the answers. And it seemed all sort of random and guesswork. So he had to determine not only what the sort of right answers were for women that would be compatible with him, but also how much relative weight each of the users would place on such types of answers. And what I thought was fascinating was the correlations. They were just clusters of similarities between certain users. Like, he had two groups of women that he sort of settled upon. One, the, you know, younger 20-something creative types, and they were more likely to live on the east side of town and have a tattoo. So he called that cluster tattoo. And then there was an older group of women who were in his eligible group who were more commitment-minded, and they were more likely to have a mid-sized dog. So he called those dog. It's just a really cute article. yeah, he definitely has some skills.
But is that a little bit creepy? I mean, you two as women, thinking back to your, you know, earlier days, you know, if a dude was compiling information, I mean, would that be some kind of indicator of how he was going to be in a relationship with you?
Yeah. Let's just say I would have a really strong password on my phone.
I mean, it's you know, there's always on the internet a corollary for every maxim, you know, and I think that the one that applies here is stalking is caring.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm glad I've always just tried to put that laid back vibe out there. So that's worked for me so far. I've been married for 12 years and, you know, so far I haven't, you know, anyway, if I could only been smart enough to do something like that, who knows?
Yeah. One could look at this and say it was making a better OkCupid, but a personal one. So fascinating. There is no legal ramification to this at the moment, but it's interesting that there could be because of his gathering up of the data. Another interesting Computer Fraud and Abuse Act case that Professor Goldman wrote up at the very end of last year. It was a little bit, it had been in his tank as far as things to post on his blog for about a month at that point, because he thought it was such an interesting case. He was thinking of putting it on his delightful internet law exam, but didn't do that. So then he finally posted his write-up of this case. And the reason he, I think, thinks it's so delightful is because the company that was complaining about having been scraped is a company that contracts with governmental entities like counties and cities to make public records available online. So having made those more readily accessible, it then got a bit huffy when someone was scraping their data and using it in ways that, I guess, their own terms of service, Fidlar was the name of the company, Fidlar Technologies, didn't authorize. So the two parties, Fidlar sued this other party, which is called LPS. It's a data analytics company that primarily aggregates data relating to real property, writes Professor Goldman here. It often goes to counties directly, but if that's not feasible, it obtains a subscription to access the county's data and has the option of getting the data via microfiche, et cetera. So I guess it just looked at Fidlar and went, well, that makes our lives a whole lot easier. They've got all the data. We're just going to scrape it. So the two parties sued each other. And in fact, LPS sought an injunction to keep it from being blocked on Fidlar's site. As far as I can tell, the case is still pending because what was decided here was whether LPS, the scraper, would be entitled to a preliminary injunction, and the court decided no. So some interesting ramifications and analysis under the CFAA. There was no... actually, the court didn't rule on whether there could have been a trespass to chattels, and that claim is still alive. That's the claim that could say that possibly the activity affected the functioning of Fidlar's servers. So they may be able to get some mileage out of that, depending on the extent of the impact they can show. But the court did find that it did not think data was something that could be trespassed. So under the CFAA, though, the court found there was not a threshold damage showing and decided that, let's see, am I reading this right, Evan?
Yes. That it did find there was a threshold damage.
I thought I was going down the wrong road there. Yes. So was the injunction granted under, I think the injunction was denied across the board, was it not?
Yes, and I thought this was a motion to dismiss. That's how I was reading it, but I might have been going down the primrose path when I was reading it as well. But all I do know is that the CFAA claim that the court did find that it was, that they did assert damages, mm-hmm. which is always, usually a pretty important part of pleading a Computer Fraud and Abuse Act claim, because it has to be sort of some sort of diminution of the system here. So that goes forward. It didn't get knocked out.
Stayed alive too. Any other thoughts on this case?
Well, this is one of those situations where, you know, you kind of go back and forth and see both sides and bring in doctrines from other areas of the law to support your wavering from one side to the other. I mean, you know, copyright law, for example, since 1991 in the Feist case has done away with the sweat of the brow doctrine, which would do away with any sensibility you may have to think, well, you know, Fidlar worked so hard to obtain this stuff, it ought to have some sort of protection on it then. Then you've got the side of saying, well, these are public records. And just because a private entity has gathered up public records, why should they be entitled to have exclusivity to them and not be forced to allow other people to access them? But then you can say, well, going back to my warehouse across town scenario that I was talking about in the last discussion here, if they'd made photocopies of all this stuff, you wouldn't think, well, you ought to be able to just walk right into their office anytime and take copies of the paper that they've made. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's tough, you know, the fact that data scraping technologies allow us to do this, and it's ostensibly information that is not subject to another form of intellectual property protection. It's not, you know, copyrightable. It's public information. You know, it mm-hmm. becomes a tricky scenario as to how to give credit and legal protection to the efforts one private enterprise has made to, you know, have this data existing somewhere and allow conditions on it, on access to it.
Right. Professor Goldman wraps it up by saying, I put this lawsuit in the same category as red light cameras and the DOD's licensing of public domain photos. All too often, we see private vendors and government entities conspire with each other to charge public citizens a second time for services the government has already been paid to do. But as you say, Evan, even if that's the kind of arrangement they've set up, there doesn't seem to be anything illegal about it. And then, you know, when you throw the CFAA and trespass to chattels into it, is it okay, just because it's a public records database, to go ahead and access the site in a way that someone like Fidlar hasn't authorized? What do you think, Lisa?
Oh, I think that it's very similar in a way, I think, to the case involving Aaron Swartz and Pacer. You know, he decided he was going to liberate all these public record court documents by writing scripts that could just download massive amounts of court records. And normally Pacer charges a few cents a page for that, but I apparently there was a day or two that they were providing unlimited amounts of court data. And so I think that it's sort of a question of where do you want to create economic incentives? Here, the makers of Fidlar, or actually it's Laredo Fidlar, I think is the company. They created a useful service, and I think it may have been Venkat Balasubrami who wrote the article on Professor Goldman's blog. I'm not sure if it was Goldman or Venkat yeah. that did that. But anyway, you know, he puts a lot of political glosses on it. I mean, ultimately, I do agree with Venkat that there shouldn't be too much rent taking and profiteering from what should be public records. But also, if you have a license and you're going to license out your proprietary software product, I guess you can assert your terms of use. I think the interesting question was whether, and I didn't read the case carefully enough to discern this, whether there was anything specific in the terms of use that would have prevented the defendant from doing this. Because if you're going to write, so basically what the technology was it had sort of a skin that was somewhat proprietary that required a username and a password to get into the public records. But apparently, once you typed in your password and username, the product ran fairly standard protocols. So it was very easy for the defendant here to sort of engineer running those things automatically once it was inside the system. But the CFAA is pretty vague and it's pretty broad. And it says that if the plaintiff suffers $5,000 worth of damage, you can bring a claim. And that can be $5,000 even just in, quote, remedial measures. So, you know, that's pretty easy to allege. And, you know, I guess we'll see if the court thinks that this is the type of unauthorized or excessive, you know, acting in excess of authority that the statute was designed to prohibit. So on one hand, you know, it's a pretty untested area of law. And I don't know what the dollar amounts are involved, but eventually over time, you know, you would hope that county property records or something that's fairly accessible and fairly affordable to the public. So I definitely agree with Venkat's gloss on the case there.
All right. Well, you raised the specter of Bitcoin a little while ago, Lisa. let's talk about this piece that Evan pointed to earlier in the week on CNN, written by David Z. Morris, who calls Bitcoin Napster for finance. Talk about it in an incendiary headline. Where is he going with that, Evan, and how is he making that analogy?
Well, it in the fact that it's a decentralized form of finance, and the implications could be much broader for it in the future than just the Bitcoin, you know, the fact of the Bitcoin protocol and the notion of decentralized finance could have broader implications in the future for more robust forms of kind of self-executing financial transactions and confirmation of transactions, much broader than just sort of, you know, buying drugs on Silk Road. So he outlines in a very sophisticated way sort of a smart finance of the future where transactions are much smoother, much more automated, and it seems to, if anything, even be broader than the notion of what we know of Bitcoin now, but seeing kind of a whole fundamental shift in the way the financial sector works into a more decentralized method than what it is now with investment firms and banking and the like there. So, you know, it's complex. It's a very erudite, esoteric piece. So I think it's interesting to see a kind of a sensible look into the future of where alternate forms of finance could be going as these things take off.
Yeah. Hey, I'm going to go ahead and reveal my own just, you know, deer in the headlights lack of appreciation of the whole Bitcoin universe, even though I read that little article that we highlighted, I forget if it was last week or the week before, about explaining Bitcoin as though you were five. My son is 10, and I was trying to explain Bitcoin to him because he's heard of it and is attempting to understand it himself. And he tossed a question out to me that I couldn't answer. So I'm asking you guys and IRC, as I was describing, you know, how does one get Bitcoins? Well, one purchases them, correct? You buy them from people who already have Bitcoins. And so my son's question was, well, who got the original money? You know, who made the first Bitcoin and where did, you know, how... Evan, try and set me straight here. Where does the money go? Is it just a pyramid scheme?
I just, you got to ask Jerry Brito. I'm not going to try to answer any. Which,
all right,
by the way, there is a really, he was on the Vice podcast sometime in the last couple of weeks or since the beginning of the year. And I would commend that to everybody. You know, he's a friend of the show, been on here a few times, and it's an hour long conversation, kind of Charlie Rose style, with Jerry Brito talking about Bitcoin and you know, some of the fundamental concerns like what your son was raising, and also very visionary into the future as to where it's going. So I would commend that. That's on YouTube, you know, the Vice podcast, Jerry Brito.
Right. Mick in IRC says, ask Leo, people just donate them. So I guess that's the way we get Bitcoins. But you buy them or you mine them. I don't, you know, the mining thing is, I guess, beyond me too. But, you know, the first person who came up with Bitcoin and sold it to, you know, in the terms of the article about explaining it to a five-year-old, you have an apple and you sell the apple, you know, but... the apple has some intrinsic value. I guess someone decided the first Bitcoin had an intrinsic value. But I don't know, you know, how did they, anybody know how they control the supply of Bitcoin and how more Bitcoins are put into the market? And is there, since it's decentralized, is that controlled by any sort of?
I mean, the way new ones are put into the market is they're mined, and that involves, you know, modifying the original, you know, this whole blockchain that's going on there. So you have to have a very powerful computer to generate more. And that,
my son and I are going to sit down and watch Steve Gibson on Security Now and try and figure this all out. Lisa, any thoughts on the Napster analogy here?
Yeah, I do have a couple thoughts. You know, I found the comments to that article very entertaining because the top voted comment was saying, well, actually, it's more like the BitTorrent of currency because Napster had centralized servers, whereas BitTorrent doesn't. But the point is the same. I mean, it's disrupting a very sort of profitable and mysterious industry. I mean, you just think of all the pseudo value or value created on Wall Street for, you know, trading currencies, swap defaults, all those kinds of things. And you think, where are these millions of dollars coming from? You know, what justifies these salaries? And you see, you know, articles all the time about wealth becoming more and more concentrated in the upper percentiles. So I too am very intrigued by Bitcoin. And I like the idea that it's built very deliberately from what sounds like a very sensible protocol. Maybe we should all go to that Bitcoin conference in May that you retweeted on Twitter that somebody's putting on to understand it. But I mean, my understanding of it is mining comes somehow from some creation of value or some work or some labor that, according to the Bitcoin protocol, is eligible to create new Bitcoin. But that's totally sort of off the cuff. What I do think is fascinating is how more and more of these mainstream retailers and companies announce that they are accepting Bitcoin as currency. So I think we should probably all figure that out.
Sooner rather than later.
Time. Yeah.
And spring, I guess, is coming, so that's good. Let's give that conference a plug. It's Rich Santalesa. He's RichNet on Twitter. Is organizing a conference to review legal, tech, and other implications of Bitcoin. So that's probably a good thing to give a lot of thought to. Evan, you spotted that, I think.
Yes, I know Rich, and I saw that he had tweeted about that, and it is just in the kind of the formation stage right now. There hasn't been a date set, but Rich is a smart guy, a good guy. He'll put on a good conference. So, you know, it's kind of like a invitation now for us, like, get together and come up with ideas and, you know, see what he could make of this. So it'll likely be in New York City around there. But everybody should follow RichNet on Twitter and, you know, see what he's got in the works for that. It looks promising.
Good, good. All right. Well, let's do an entertainment-related story to wrap things up. So it's been the case for a while that if you walk into a movie theater with your handheld camcorder, take it out, aim it at the screen, start recording the movie, you're going to get yourself into a world of hot water with the theater owner, the MPAA, et cetera. You may well find yourself prosecuted for doing that. Well, should the same thing happen if you walk in there wearing your Google Glass? Apparently, that is the kind of experience that a person had when they went into the theater wearing glass. This person, I'm trying to find his name. I don't know if that's publicly part of this story, but I'm not seeing
it. Thought it wasn't. He was, staying anonymous when I read it. Maybe it's out there
so
now.
It's a man. He went into the theater wearing glass and was questioned by officers of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Bureau, so the ICE folks, who actually, you know, this gets down to our, you know, border search and discussions about when you have to give people access to your devices. They actually plugged his glass in to a laptop, and he, I guess, authorized them to go ahead and take a look.
I hope he hadn't downloaded that new sex app. Have you seen about that on Glass?
Yes, anyway. Exactly. Let's hope he hadn't. That could be embarrassing. But, you know, they started going through his personal photos and things and just determining that, indeed, he hadn't recorded the film. That seems like a problematic aspect right there. But just the fact that someone, you know, we all have phones in our pockets when we go to movies, the ability to make a film of a film clandestinely certainly isn't limited to wearable technology like glass. So you could certainly do it a lot more stealthily than the example that I began this discussion with, holding up a rather obvious looking camcorder. So Evan, what do you think about this?
Oh, don't we just love stories like this where cops look like idiots because they don't understand technology and like, oh, look at this guy. He's, you know, being trampled on and all that stuff. So, I mean, the obvious comparison is with the woman who was arrested and later acquitted for wearing glass while driving. And I think the issues in that are very different because there was a bigger issue of public safety. But isn't it interesting? You get the full weight of the federal government. Well, I'm overstating that, but you get the feds coming in, and as the picture that would be painted for us is, you know, really strong-handed this guy for over potential content piracy. You know, isn't that just you know, doesn't that play into the narrative that's so fun to talk about here of sort of the ridiculous aspect of all this. And so
the story is so strange. What's up with the officer identifying himself as Bob Hope? I mean, really, I guess it could have been his name, but you certainly
well, did
wouldn't.
Did you see that Will Ferrell sued Apple this past week?
Yes, you know, some I did see that. Not
people
that
aren't,
Will Ferrell.
People just, yeah.
Oh, not that they, Will Ferrell.
Exactly. Another Will Ferrell. So
I don't
maybe
know. It was just some
another
dude named William Ferrell. You know, he's a plaintiff in a class action lawsuit against that. So,
and maybe this officer isn't some dude named Robert Hope, but it just seems too strange in this kind of story.
We could hope. So, yeah. But I mean, the whole point of this is, you know, there's a learning curve on in these enforcement. So there's two things really. I mean, there's the learning curve in enforcing the rule of law and order and things when technology presents, you know, strange new things. But then there's also the absurdity of the overreaching sensibilities of protecting content from piracy. So those two things combine here to make a funny story. That's good to talk about. Obviously, the third element being Google Glass. I guess that's already the one element. So yeah, there's just a couple of things that you know mix up together, and it's a good story to talk about.
Yeah, the other thing that was interesting is apparently there was some MPAA representative just hanging out in this movie theater, who I guess was the precipitating force behind calling in federal agents on this guy, which. You know, you don't necessarily think of the MPAA surveying movie theaters.
I think they
around
in
the country.
Yeah. I think they swooped in the very same helicopters that were in New Zealand to get Kim.com last year. It's the very same ones. They landed on the roof and came in through, they rappelled in from the ceiling in the movie theater and stuff.
Yes.
That's the report I read.
Big content is watching you. Lisa, what do you think? I mean, obviously, this guy, there are a few different levels to this. I think it's disturbing that they asked for and he went ahead and let them, even though he was not under arrest or being charged with anything, take a look at what was on his device, same as turning your phone over and saying, here, take a look. What do you think about that?
I think it's a bizarre story all around. I think that, I mean, it's such a first world problem. You know, I paid to see the new Jack Ryan movie and they took my Google Glass. I mean, it's such an unusual accessory. I mean, it just seems to cry out for attention, you know? So How about not wearing your Google Glass to the movie theater? And then on the other hand, is this really our best use of tax dollars? You know, here you have a guy, he actually paid to go to a movie theater to see a movie. Like, why are you targeting your activities on this guy? I mean, I know what they're saying. They're saying, oh, he may have been surreptitiously recording the film. But, you know, I mean, somebody could. I don't know that well how Google Glass actually operates. I know you need to write like an essay and pay $800 to get Google Glass. It's sort of a nonsensical story all around. Yeah. But
this person's were actually prescription. Now, presumably he has another pair of prescription glasses he could have worn to the movies. But, you know, I mean, it's like you're going to put your phone on silent and leave it in your pocket and go to the movies. And maybe this was the person who uses Google Glass like their phone. You know, it's just part of their tech that they bring around with them and use in their daily lives. And yeah, it's a first world problem, but it's a first world, I think, forward looking problem as wearable technology becomes less of a novelty and more part of the fabric of society. You know, are we going to see more and more of this kind of overreaction? What do you think, Evan?
Well, I mean, it'll be in different forms, sure, as technology allows, as technology becomes more integrated. And, you know, this is kind of becoming a theme that we're talking about. It's only going to get more, you know, once law enforcement and the powers that be, both in the public sector and the private sector, you know, learn to deal with something as external as Google Glass, technology will become integrated and brought into the body even more, you know, within, I don't even want to guess how many years. It's probably shorter than any of us could imagine. You'll be able to record high definition film through your contact lenses, probably. I mean, you know, that sounds like total science fiction now, but you know, 30 years ago, the smartphone and so many other things. The fact that we could be having this conversation now cross country like this in high definition videos, just with equipment that we have at home, is mind boggling. So. Sure, there will always be stories like this, just taking different incarnations.
Well, one idea that I had about this was, you know, we say in Hollywood, no bad publicity. I mean, we don't even know that this isn't just a giant publicity stunt by the producers of the movie. I mean, the guy's anonymous after all, you know, no bad publicity. So maybe right. Next week we'll hear that this was this Bob Hope and this, you know, Google Glassware was a joint marketing effort by Google and the MPAA. But, you know, they should work together. I mean, they should have a QR code or something that the Google Glass user can scan over to, you know, assure the movie makers that they're not going to be pirating the movie. I'm sure it's coming.
Exactly. Well, and as you say, you know, the MPAA does like to get out its message that if you have technology that can record a movie on you, you know, we're going to be watching you. So they want you to get that message. Let's make mind-boggling our second MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. So we have Muggies and mind-boggling. So we have two double G consonant ones for you. So keep track of those. And let's move on to our resources and tip of the week. Let's start with our tip, which is very much in line with a lot of the stories we've discussed today about people using the Communications Decency Act as a shield for conduct that most people would say is deplorable. Hunter Moore, our favorite villain we love to chat about, has actually gotten arrested. And there's a great story giving all the background on this over on Cash Hill's site, The Not So Private Parts. And the tip that I cobbled together out of this has to do with a woman named, I think her first name is Kayla Laws. And she was really the driving force behind Moore getting arrested. She's a 25-year-old aspiring actress who I think did not agree with the no publicity is bad publicity premise, because what Moore and another person is being accused of here is as though they were not getting enough pictures submitted to Is Anyone Up, they're alleged to have hacked into people's Gmail and Yahoo accounts to try and find nudie photos there that had never, you know, may never have been shared with anyone else. And that's what Kayla Laws says happened to her, that she actually had some photos of herself that were only in her email account that she'd taken with her phone and then emailed to herself, that they hacked into her account and got. And when she went to law enforcement describing this and saying how her account must have been hacked to get these photos that wound up on Hunter Moore's site, she said the first detective at the LAPD that she talked to was unsympathetic. But then she went to the FBI and told them that if they helped Scarlett Johansson after her naked photos got hacked, they had to help Kayla too. And so there's our tip of the week. Invoke Scarlett Johansson whenever possible if you want to achieve an effect. And apparently that actually works, because one of the prosecutors who went after Johansson's hacker is listed on as one of the prosecutors on this indictment. So at least the FBI is listening to arguments that they should be consistent. Evan, any thoughts on Hunter Moore deciding that they weren't getting enough photos, even though they told Cash Hill when she interviewed Moore, he said he had an almost endless stream of photos coming into the site. Apparently that wasn't enough, according to these allegations and this indictment anyway. And they went a step further.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's so much to say about Hunter Moore, but most of it's not even worth saying, because he's not even worth, you know, using the brain cycles to formulate it. But, you know, it's been a long time coming. You know, there's been the grand jury that was looking into this, and then the indictment was just unsealed yesterday when he was finally arrested. But, you know, it's been interesting to see this happen, because I had several victims from Is Anyone Up contact me over the last few years, you know, who swore up and down that this was happening to them. And so it's really interesting to see kind of the whole picture start to develop here of something much more nefarious than posting the site itself, of this back end activity that was going on in trying to get these photos in an unscrupulous way. And that ultimately just cuts the Gordian knot of the difficulty of prosecuting him for publishing the site. This other thing, this violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and violation of other laws, including identity theft, ultimately is what can what prosecutors can hang their hats on. So it's interesting to see this come around this way.
Lisa, you want to weigh in on Hunter Moore getting arrested?
Yeah, I was reading the articles about it yesterday, and it looked like he had sort of ceased the conduct before he was actually arrested and was trying to shut down his website back in April 2012. So it just takes the wheels a little bit of time to turn. I don't know about other states, but I think California criminalized this exact thing sometime last year, that basically they added a gloss on the existing statute that said that anyone who sort of hacks into a closed system to get explicit photographs of you specifically to post them without your consent is guilty of a crime. And I remember thinking at the time when I was looking at that statute that one of the interesting things about it was that it had been drafted with an exclusion for anyone that you had sent them to. So in other words, you know, typical case, you get a call from someone who says, oh, you know, I gave my boyfriend photos of me and we broke up and now he's posting them. In that scenario, this California law wouldn't apply. But here's a case that, I mean, clearly was the exact kind of conduct that the law was intended to deter. I think he deserves what's coming to him. I mean, that's a horrible thing. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I don't think the Communications Decency Act is going to ride to his rescue here. Let's give you a couple of resources, too. I heard from Arik Sternberg, who pointed me toward his site, The Supreme TV. And the Court Supreme is this fictional court that he has created in which he is planning to put all of online culture, history, science, and literature on trial. And he has a number of videos up already. We've got one queued up to show you just what...
My patron...
Give you a sample.
...brings before us today a matter of larceny, a conceptual thievery most foul...
Sword. Keep it short.
1,000 apologies, Your Lordship. My patron, Nightman, is demanding that the accused, the urban rebel known as Nightingale, must immediately desist from using my client's trademark during his vengeful activities.
Well said, sword. Shield.
He's having some fun. He's created this fictional court. The shield, the sword, and the eye are the defense attorney, the prosecutor, and the judge. And he has 4 or 5 different episodes now where they dramatize some sort of legal issue, and it's a little bit like when Q puts people on trial on The Next Generation. I sort of have that feel from it, but it looks entertaining. And he did say that he had been inspired by watching our show to create his own content and put things online. I don't know if we're being socially engineered there to give the Court Supreme a plug, but happy to do it. It looks interesting. Also want to give a plug to Warren Allen and friends, the folks behind the legal hackathons, where we get smart people together and try and come up with solutions to difficult legal issues. They have a data privacy legal hackathon coming up on February 8th through 9th in Mountain View, in New York, and in London, all on the same day. So do check that out if you are someone interested in data privacy and have good ideas to contribute. Would be great to have you do that and attend and make the world a better place. The Legal Hackers also have lots of resources on their site. And one I'd like to highlight is their Hacking Revenge Porn session. This was just put up on January 14th. So since we've been talking about revenge porn and revenge porn laws, here were the ideas and solutions that were suggested at this Legal Hackers event for that. Bearing in mind that, as Lisa pointed out, California has a criminal revenge porn law now, and as does New Jersey, I think. But as far as I know, nowhere else does. So the states are still trying to wrestle with this, and these folks at the Legal Hackers are definitely trying to help them do it with good ideas. So check that out if that is something that you're interested in. And we're certainly interested in having you join us every week when we do the show on Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. If you have that time slot available for us, we thank you. You can find us just at twit.tv. Go watch us live. But if you can't do that, you can certainly come catch up with us on your very own schedule by going to twit.tv/twill. We've got our archive of shows there. Also, if YouTube makes things easier for you, we're there too on youtube.com/thisweekinlaw, on iTunes, on Roku. My Roku just died, the one that we've had since the beginning of Roku. So I get to set up whatever their newest model is, Model 3, and get all my... Hopefully, I'm hoping when I log into my account, all my channels just come back over. And the Twit channel is certainly one of the ones that I enjoy on the Roku. What else? It's just been such a fun show. I'm so glad we could circle back with you, Lisa. Can't believe it's already been a year. Where does the time go?
I don't know. I've been making it's Bitcoin.
Stunning. I know you and I were talking about getting... Yeah, you've been just mining Bitcoin the whole time. You and I were talking about getting together for lunch. We haven't managed to do that.
Only taken 3 years. I will hit you up offline, but it's been a pleasure. And, you know, this internet keeps evolving at light speed. And it's always fun to talk to you and Evan. So thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Evan, great to chat with you.
Yes, as always, same here. Really, really enjoyed it. Lisa, great to talk to you. If you're ever coming back home to Illinois, be sure to reach out. You know, we can...
Definitely. Hang in there in the polar vortex.
Oh, it is... Yes, it is. It's chilly here today. You're not missing a thing. It's the wind today. So yesterday on my way into the city, you know, when I got out of the car at the train station, heard on the radio, -23 wind chill. So I stopped and said to myself, you know, remember this moment. This is what winter is all about. So there you have it.
All right, stay where you are. Stay warm, Evan. Yeah, we'll hold down the fort here in Southern California, where we definitely need rain. So, you know, if anyone knows any good rain dances for us, please do them, because all of California needs rain right now. We could use some of your snow. We'll let you keep the wind, Evan. Also, if you're going to do an interesting, creative show about quartz and star chambers, or have any other reason to contact us, do that. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Evan is Evan at twit.tv. He's Internet Cases on Twitter. I'm D Howell there. And we love to hear from you in any way, shape, or form that you can cobble together. We've got a Facebook page for that purpose, and a Google Plus page, and a Google Plus community. Hit us up. Let us know your ideas for the show, for guests, your comments and feedback about things we've discussed, and things that you think that we should be looking at down the road. Lisa, before we wrap, anything you want to bring us up to speed on? Anything besides the fact that folks going to South by Southwest should look you up? Anything else going on?
Oh, you know, just the usual, just lawyering, managing. Hit me up on Twitter at lisabarodkin.com or on Facebook. Evan, I didn't know that you were not on Facebook. I thought you had just unfriended me for some reason that I could not fathom.
No.
But I suppose you wanted to keep your credit worthiness up, and you thought
That's right. I want my credit to be as good as I can, because one of these days I'm going to trade in my 1998 Nissan Maxima. So get out of this weather.
No, say it ain't so. Oh, look, we're snowing on Evan. Close that skylight.
Yeah. Well, let's not be strangers, and let's stay on top of all this good stuff.
Yes, definitely. Thanks again, Lisa. We'll talk to you soon, I hope.
All right. Have a great weekend, everyone.
All right. And everyone out there, indeed, have a great weekend. And we'll see you next time on This Week in Law.